So we simply begin to see that maybe we have a choice in this anger thing. Maybe if we get our instincts under control, maybe if our relationship with God is okay, then what people do and say to us doesn't upset us, and we don't have to get mad, and we don't end up getting drunk over those situations. So we learn really three good things just by filling out the sheets. Number one, how angry we really are, how many resentments we really do have. Number two, it's not them we resent, it's what they've done to us. Number three, it's really not even what they've done to us. It's how we choose to react to it based upon our instincts and our relationship with God. Another thing I think you'll find in column three is you'll begin to see at least one part of self really stand out. Some of us, if we keep checking under social instinct, self-esteem, we'll begin to see where that's really a problem for us. Others, maybe we'll be checking more under the security instinct, or maybe even under the sex instinct. There's probably going to be a combination of all three, but I think each one of us individually will begin to see at least one part of self that really stands out and gives us a real problem when it comes to our reaction to other people. Valuable information. After we filled out those three columns, we began to realize how much time we've really wasted in resentments. The book says when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And most of us have found that we spent literally thousands of hours in the past through resentments, trying to get even with them and so on and so forth. We found it really didn't do us any good whatsoever. Absolute, complete wasted time. We also found that when harboring these resentments, we're shut off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And shut off from the sunlight of the Spirit, we don't feel good. And if we don't feel good, eventually we start thinking about taking a drink, and we end up drunk all over again. And that, the book says that's the main problem with the resentments. They will cause us to get drunk. It suggested we go back now and look at it from a different angle entirely. Always before we look to see what those suckers have done to us, today we look to see what that resentment is doing to us. And if it's going to block us off from God and get us drunk, then we're certainly looking at it from an entirely different angle. The book also talks about the fact we begin to realize that the world and the people have really dominated us through our resentments toward them. I always thought I had it. Nobody told me what to do. I didn't need anybody else's advice. And I suddenly realized that other people have told me what to do and control my thinking and my actions and my life throughout my entire lifetime. Always acting and reacting based upon what other people said and what other people did. That began to look kind of stupid to do that. And about 95% of the resentments automatically began to disappear when I saw how stupid they really were. We found a way, too, for those resentments that were deeply, deeply embedded that didn't automatically begin to disappear when we saw the stupidity behind them. We saw that we could pray for those people also. And through the praying for those people, the prayer, which is an expression of love, actually overcame the anger and the resentment. And we found we could be resentment-free to the level that God intended for us to be. As the resentments disappeared, they had to be replaced with something else. And that part of our mind, which had been controlled by resentments, now is controlled by love, patience, tolerance, compassion, and goodwill toward our fellow man. That's God's thinking. Automatically, it takes the place of the resentments. We found we didn't have to go to any other fellowships, read any other books, to get love, patience, tolerance, compassion, and goodwill. If God dwells within us, that's always been a part of our makeup. Just never could use it before. But now that the resentments are gone, it automatically comes to the surface. And much less chance of getting drunk now than we were before we started the inventory process. The final thing we had to look at was, it would do no good to get rid of resentments today if I didn't know how to keep them from coming back in the future. Because the world's full of sick people. They're going to do it to me again tomorrow. So the book suggested I go back and look at that column 4 and 5 and look to see the part that I had played in those resentments in the past. In the fourth column, we listed, well, what did we do to set that thing in motion? And we begin to realize that with practically all of our resentments, that we ourselves had made a decision, taken action based on self that ended up hurting other people and institutions. They, in turn, had retaliated against us we in turn had resented them for doing so. And as we played the resentments over and over and over and over in our head, we distorted the picture, finally transferred all blame to them, and made ourselves as pure as the driven snow. My God, no wonder we loved our resentments. It's a way to go ahead and excuse ourselves, never have to look and see what we're doing, and continue living life the way we wanted to live it. We didn't recognize that until we filled out the fourth column. The final thing we looked at was in the fifth column. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, resentment, self-seeking, frightened, inconsiderate, etc.? In the fifth column, we began to see the exact nature of the wrong, the character defects within ourselves, within our personality, that caused us to do the things that hurt other people. We began to see if we don't do something about the removal of those things, then sooner or later we're going to keep right on doing the same old things, keep right on hurting people, keep right on resenting until we end up drunk over it. So we began to see if we could become a little less selfish, a little less dishonest, a little less self-seeking, frightened, a little less inconsiderate, then maybe we wouldn't be hurting people in institutions. They wouldn't retaliate, we wouldn't resent, and maybe we could find a little peace of mind and serenity and happiness. As we ended up with that thing, we found that we were doing step four, the resentment part of it. We found in the fifth column the exact nature of the wrong we're going to talk about to another human being. The resentment being the wrong, but what's the real truth of it? What's at the core of it? We found in the fifth column the character defects we're going to be willing to turn loose of in step six. We found in the fifth column the shortcomings we're going to ask God to take away in step seven. And also we found that the majority of the names in column one were people and institutions that we had harmed. Therefore, their names will come off of that sheet and be added to a sheet to be later on for steps 8 and 9. So basically, we've got all the information we need now, resentment-wise, for steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And we're going to follow just exactly the same procedure in order to be able to look at the second common manifestation of self, which is fears. We're going to use the same procedure to look at the harms we've done to others in the sexual area. We're going to use the same procedure to look at the harms we've done to others other than sex. When we get through with those other sheets, we will then have completed our inventory. Right now, let's look at the second common manifestation of self, which will be fears. It starts on the bottom of page 67. Go.
Before we go to 67, let's turn to page 18 for just briefly. And we are going to talk about a lot about fears this morning, and I have to reiterate again for myself as well as anybody else who might be interested, but we're not going to psychoanalyze ourselves. Most people, when they begin to look at their fears, they psychoanalyze themselves. They say that the reason I have all these fears is because Mama set me on the potty training chair backwards or something. But we're not going to do that. We're just not going to engage in that type of activity. What we are going to do is try to do what the book says. We're going to find the facts, we're going to face the facts, and then we'll engage in a process so we can accept the facts. And remember again that it said over there on page 64, I believe, it said that spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Spiritual not only means my relationship with God, it means my whole total being, my spiritual being. And whenever I am resentful or fearful, I don't just get resentful and fearful in one area. My whole being, my whole spiritual being is affected. I'm resentful and fearful everywhere. And, of course, I didn't know that. And remember, Dr. Jung said the ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were the guiding force that lies these people, are suddenly cast to one side. My ideas, emotions, and attitudes. And on page 18, the top of the page saying that one paragraph tells my whole story, really. And it says, an illness of this sort, and we've come to believe it, an illness involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic illness. For with it goes annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents, and anyone can increase the list. In other words, alcoholism is a family illness. And if you live with one of us very long as a practicing alcoholic, you're going to be affected by it in some manner. And as I look back into my life, I can see that my dad, I know today he had an obsession to drink. My mother had an obsession to see that he didn't drink. You see? And I grew up in this. My dad was an ice man in Tulsa. We went to California from the country, came back to Tulsa, and he became an ice man, backbreaking work 6 days a week carrying ice to people's houses back in those days. And on Saturday, he'd get paid, and he'd come back by the bootleg and buy him a pint of whiskey. He needed a drink. He wanted a drink. He deserved a drink, I think, after that 6 days of work. And he'd come in with his dollar pint of whiskey, which was what it cost in those days. And my mother saw that dollar going for that pint of whiskey that could have gone to feed these five kids she had. And she began to raise hell with my dad about his drinking. And, of course, you know how that is. My dad raised hell back with her. And I grew up in this. And we know that alcoholism is a progressive illness. It gets worse as time goes by. And my dad continued to drink. My mother continued to raise hell with him. And there began to be physical fights and verbal fights in my house. And I grew up in this. And I was affected by it emotionally. From time to time, my dad would tell us kids, said, boys, I'm going to take your mom out and kill her this weekend. Drunk. And I'm just five, six, 7 years old, and I believe he's going to do that. And I was affected emotionally about this. And I'd be sat home all weekend wondering if he's going to do that this time. Is he really going to do that? So I was affected by it. My dad began to pull out knives and guns around the house, and he got pretty violent. And my mother had to have him arrested and committed to the Eastern State Hospital of Bonita, which is our local nut house. And he was an alcoholic, and he was to stay there until he got well. Think about that. And they didn't have alcoholic treatment in 1949, but they did have a criminally insane ward. And that's what they did with alcoholics in those days. They put them in the criminally insane ward and they were to stay there until they got well. Now, some of the most formidable years of my life, my dad was there for 3 years and 7 months and 13 days. And he was an alcoholic. No way out for him. And I used to hitchhike up there, my brother and I, and take him a carton of cigarettes and a couple of dollars from time to time. And I was able to go into the criminally insane ward, and I saw my dad in there and with those other people. And it was quite scary. I saw things you're not supposed to see, and nobody. And I began, as I would come home from there, my brother and I hitchhiking, I got some ideas, emotions, and attitudes which would become the guiding force of my life. And one of them was this. I said, if God, you know, you got to blame it on somebody, right? If God is going to do this to me and to us, to hell with him, I'll not be going. If I ever get big enough they can't catch me, I'm not going. The church, that is. And I didn't go. To hell with God, what I said to myself. And another thought came to me along that line someplace was that if it hurts like this to love people, I'm going to quit loving people. It hurts too bad. So I began to push people out of my life. And another thought came to me was this. If anything good is going to happen in my life, it's going to happen because I alone made it that way. That just came to me. I didn't have any help with that at all. I'm good at that, you know. So I didn't need God, nothing, or nobody. And that's the way I live my life. Now, that's not very good coping skills, by the way. And when I got here, I had the spiritual knowledge of a 7-year-old boy. I had the coping skills of an 8- or 9-year-old boy. And I had the sexual knowledge of an 11 or 12-year-old boy that I learned on the streets. Do you think I didn't need to do some inventory? Yeah. So let's look back now at, I used to think all along that those ideas, emotions, and attitudes I had were very, very brave on my part. But come to find out, the most fearful thoughts that you could possibly have. Of course, I didn't know that. And if you threatened me, or I perceived a threat from you, in any manner, it was not good. Not good for you. I lash out at people. Over in my part of the neighborhood at school, Charlie lived up the road about 3 miles. There's two kinds of people. There was those people that ran home from school, and then there was those people who ran people home from school. And that was me. I run people home from school because they ever got you running, you couldn't quit. That's the way it was around my area. And I didn't want to be one of those. So out of fear, that's what I did. You see. Okay, page 67, bottom of the page. Notice that the word fear is bracketed along the side of the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Miss Jones, the employer, and the wife. See, this short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. I don't get just fearful one place. It's about every aspect of my life. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think that fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. And here we go. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had them. And here it is for me. Wasn't it because that self-reliance failed me? I didn't need God, nothing, or nobody. Totally self-reliant, and it failed. Self-reliance was far as good as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse.
So we see basically the same set of instructions on that last paragraph that Joe just read, to review our fears as we had for resentments, except worded a little bit differently, which is Bill's usual way of doing things. So to avoid any confusion, we made up another little inventory sheet. We called it a review of fears. Looks almost exactly like the resentment sheet. Basically, it has the five columns on it. Column one, who or what do I fear? Now, many of us, especially we men, we say, well, we don't have very much fear. We're tough. We're macho. We're not talking about physical fear. We're talking about all those fears that run through our heads. And I didn't think I had very much fear until I started filling out that column one. And I began to find that I had fears connected with my marriage. I had fears connected with my job. I had fears connected with my children. I had fears connected with the police department. I had fears connected with the Internal Revenue Service. I had fears connected with, and as I began to fill out sheet after sheet after sheet, I began to realize how much fear I really do have. Just like with resentments, I didn't think I had very many until I put them all down on a sheet of paper and got to see them in their entirety. And I don't think any of us will ever realize how much fear we really do have. And we put them down on a sheet of paper and see them in their entirety, and we begin to realize that we've made the decision in step three to let God direct our thinking. And if we have that many fears, then God can't direct our thinking, because the fears themselves direct our thinking, direct our actions, and direct our lives for us. I don't think any of us will realize that until we fill out column one. Column two, what's the cause of the fear? You'll notice it's headed up, what are they going to do to me? Am I perhaps going to jail? Am I going to lose something with material value? Am I going to lose face? Will it result in divorce? Will it destroy a personal relationship? Might I lose my job, etc.? We are not attempting to psychoanalyze. Like Joe said, we're not going to say we're afraid of the dark because mother set us on the potty sideways when we were kids growing up. No, we're not going to say that. We're supposed to have a little bit of fear anyhow. It's like we're supposed to have some resentment. Fear brings caution. Fear keeps us from getting hurt. You know, yeah, I'm a little bit afraid of the dark. Why? Well, I don't have headlights and I can't see at night, and it keeps me from getting hurt. I'm a little bit afraid of heights. Why? Well, I don't have wings and I can't fly. It keeps me from getting hurt. But if those kind of fears should keep me from going out after dark, keep me from riding in an elevator or an airplane, I better get them on this paper and look at them, because they're controlling and ruling and dominating my life for me. I find that most of my fears are usually centered around about one or two different things. Number one, I'm usually scared to death I'm going to lose something I've already got. I'm scared to death I'm not going to get something I really want. Or I've done something I shouldn't have done, and I'm scared to death what they're going to do whenever they find out about it. If we have a fear, we have a cause for it. Column two, we simply list the cause of the fear. Column three, which part of self is affected? Just like with anger and resentment, I do not experience fear unless there's a threat to one of the basic instincts of life. If you threaten my social instinct, my personal relationships, if you threaten my security, if you threaten my sex life in any way, that's going to bring fear, an automatic reaction to those things. For the first time in my life, as I filled out the third column, just like with anger, I begin to see where fear comes from. I thought fear was just one of those thoughts that flitted through your mind. You could do nothing about it, nothing to control it. Today I realize fear comes from a threat to one of the basic instincts of life. And it's how I choose to react to it as to whether I'm going to be fearful or not. If my relationship with God is right, if my instincts are under control, you can say and do about whatever you want to me, and I'm not going to experience fear. But by the same token, if my relationship with God is not right, my instincts aren't under control, then about everything you say or do to me creates fear of one form or another. Just exactly like with resentments. Now that we understand where fear comes from, we can begin to see maybe we can do something about that. Also, just like with resentments in the third column, I think you'll probably see one part of self really stand out, and we'll begin to see how much that particular part of self controls us. Maybe our fears are mainly connected with what other people think of us. Another case, maybe our fears are primarily connected with our security. Another place, maybe it's primarily connected with our sex life. Probably going to be a combination of all three. But at least one part of self is really going to stand out and show us the part of self we're having difficulty with in the fears area, just like we did with the resentments area. Column 4. What did I do? It's headed up, what did I do, if anything, to set the ball rolling? Set in motion trains of circumstances which have led to my being in a position to have the fear. And just like with resentments, we're going to find that in the majority of the cases, sometime in the past, we've made a decision based on self, which later places us in a position to have to experience this fear. I don't think we'll ever really realize the part we play in these things until we fill out that fourth column and see the part that we've done or the decisions that we've made. If we didn't do anything, then we'd put down nothing, just like we did with the resentment. But in the majority of the cases, we'll find that we made decisions based on self, which put us in a position. Column 5, just like with the resentments. Is that fear I'm experiencing? Is it because I'm an excessively selfish person? Was it caused by dishonesty? You know, if I hadn't been lying and cheating and stealing, I wouldn't have to be afraid of what they're going to do whenever they catch me. Was it caused by my self-seeking, frightened nature in the first place? Is it caused by inconsideration of other people? Just exactly like with resentments. One or two of those things are going to stand out every time. One part of my personality is the root cause of that particular fear. So we treat it just like we did resentments, and it works out exactly the same way. Another thing I noticed also is I begin to notice on the fears sheet many of the same names that appeared on the resentment sheet. You know, I resented old Barbara, but by golly, I feared old Barbara too. In fact, I'm a little bit afraid of her today. If she ever finds out everything I was doing 30-some-odd years ago, I'll be in a hell of a mess again today if she finds I never had tied that together in my head. I don't think any of us will until we get it on this paper and we see how closely these resentments and these fears run right along with the same old names. I resented the Internal Revenue Service. I feared the Internal Revenue Service. In many cases, the same names kept appearing on those sheets. And we're in the process of doing step 4. This is the fears part of it. And once again, out in the fifth column, we're going to see the exact nature of the wrong we're going to talk about to another human being. You see, these fears stem from my selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate character. That's what we're going to be talking about in step 5 when we take this thing to another human being. I don't care how many fears a guy's got. What I'm really concerned with is what's within him that causes that fear. Is it caused by his selfishness? Is it caused by his dishonesty? His self-seeking, frightened, or his inconsiderate character? That's the root cause of it. Also in the fifth column, we're going to see exactly the same thing we did in resentments. We're going to see those character defects that we're going to become willing to turn loose of in step 6. Because if we stay selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate, we're going to keep on eating up with fear, and it's going to block us off from God, and eventually we're going to get drunk of it, out over it. Also in the fifth column, we see the shortcomings we're going to ask God to take away in step 7. And if he can take them away and we can become less selfish, less dishonest, less self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate, then we're not going to have to experience so much fear. And quite naturally, some of the names in column 1 will be people we have harmed that did not appear on the resentment sheet, and they will be taken off of this sheet, added onto the sheet to be used later on for steps 8 and 9. So we really are gathering up all the information we need for the fears section for steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. When we looked at resentments, we found a prayer there. That prayer on resentments was the first prayer on step 4 in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. We hear always about the step 3 prayers, the step 7 prayers. We never hear about the prayers in step 4. We saw a prayer for resentments, and now then we're going to see how to get rid of some of these fears. Now, if you think that resentments, when you saw the truth of them, looked stupid in your head on paper, just wait until you get a chance to really look at your fears honestly and truthfully. Your fears look awful good in your head, but when you get out on paper, they look double dumb. They look more stupid even than the resentments did when you really see the truth behind them. And once again, we alcoholics don't like to appear stupid. So about 95% of those fears are going to disappear automatically when we see the stupidity behind them. But once again, there will be 3, 4, 5, or 6 so deeply embedded, we're going to have extra help with that. We now come to the second prayer in the Big Book on step 4, Joe.
We now apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality a way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is a way of strength. The verdict of ages that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. They never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fears and direct our attention to what He have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. We see our little prayer. We ask Him to remove our fears and direct our attention to what He have us be. And He says, at once, we commence to outgrow fear. So, if we use this inventory, analyze all our fears, and seen how dumb they were and got rid of 95% of them, and then prayed to God to get rid of them and continuously to begin to ask God to remove them, we could be without fear. It's not that we're going to be in a way perfect, but we can live above these fears that's been controlling and ruling our lives. Now, when we put these things on paper, I always like to mention how we're doing it. And how the inventory process works. You put down the fears, you put down the resentments in the first column. You know, we're starting from the outside, and we're going to work in. And so we start from the name, and we put that on the first column. Then the cause, what they did. And then which part of self, we work a third column. We work from the outside in. The real exact nature, the origin of the whole thing is the fifth column. That's where it started. But you can't start. That's what we're hunting for. So we have to start from the outside to search and find the inside. Actually, it started, the resentment started from the fifth column out. You know what I mean? It's like, I resented my mother-in-law. I could just use that name, and that's all I could see about it. That's all I needed was the name and what she did. The first two columns. I played that over and over and over. But the way the real thing started, I started out on my own dishonesty, my own unselfish actions. I did these things and hit her number one. And then she did number two and stuck me number three. So I started the whole thing. But I couldn't see that in my head. I couldn't see that until I put it on paper.
Here is going to be the same identical way. Just exactly.
I myself set the ball rolling. All my fears start with me.
You know, prior to the Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have a God in my life. So who did I depend on? Me.
Me.
And our book says perhaps there's a better way. But we're now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. I've already done step 3, so I'm on a different basis. I can start trusting and relying upon God. We trust our infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we think we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? And it says down there, so we ask Him to remove our prayer and direct our attention to what He would have us be, the other prayer. I'm constantly asking God to remove the fear and direct my attention to what He would have us be. And my sponsor, Franklin, told me that the two most important things about prayer, one was to start and the other was to continue. And as I look back, Every time I have prayed in my life, I change just a fuzz, hardly noticeable to anybody, including me. And the next time I pray was just another little fuzz, hardly noticeable. And as time goes by, I can see a major, major change in me. I am not what I used to be, thank God. I have changed. I am becoming that which God intended for me to be, because that's my prayer. And these fears that I used to have that controlled and dominated my life are gone. I don't have those, and I have faith in God and trust in God today, which I didn't have before. And with that, I don't have to react to you fearfully and to overreact and harm you in any way. I don't want to do that. Sometimes I have done that, but I don't want to do that. And normally I don't do it because God is in my life.
We hear always about the promises on page 83 and 84. We never hear about the promises that are spread throughout the entire book. I think we just read one of the greatest promises today found anywhere in the book. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be instead. At once, we commence to outgrow that fear. If you got a fear that's giving you a hard time, giving you a lot of trouble, if you'll do it just like we did with resentments, if you'll ask God to remove that on a daily basis, if you'll ask Him to remove it every time it comes up, if you'll ask Him to direct your attention to what He would have you be instead, at once you commence to outgrow that fear. And you wake up some morning and that fear is gone, absolutely, completely. You know, I've had two or three instances in my life. I had a lady from New York City told me one time, she said, "Charlie, I'm absolutely scared to death to ride on that subway system." She said, "I don't have a car. I don't like buses. I really can't get around very good." She said, "What could I do about that?" I said, "Well, you do what the big book says." I said, "You ask God to remove that fear and direct your attention to what He would have you be instead, and you will commence to outgrow that." And I said, "Now, if that happens to you," I gave her my name and phone number. I said, "If that happens to you, please call me and let me know how this comes out." And I don't know when it was, maybe 60, 80, 90 days later, she did call me from New York City. And she said, "Hey, that damn thing really does work." She said, "I've been riding that subway system all over New York City, just completely exhilarated by the fact that she could do that. And this thing really does work." I just think this file cabinet that I had in my store yesterday that is filled with fears has now been emptied out. The fears are gone. And once again, the natural law applies. Nature abhors a vacuum. God's not going to leave another hole in my head. I've got enough already. If those fears disappear, they've got to be replaced with something else. The only thing that can replace them would be the opposite of the fear. And where my mind used to be filled with fear, now it's filled with faith and courage. I find I have the ability to do many, many things that I couldn't do before. I find I have the ability to quit doing some things I thought I had to do before, too. Now, if my mind is filled in that part of my mind, if it's filled with faith and courage instead of fear, then once again, I've had a very, very positive happening. See, there's nothing negative about any of these action steps. Every one of them brings about something good. If the fear has been replaced with faith and courage, I'm getting a little more peace of mind, a little more serenity, a little more happiness. I'm in much less chance of drinking now than I was before I started this process. But also, just like resentments, if you've got a fear that you don't want to get rid of it, then you better look at it very carefully. Knowing good, full well it might get you drunk, and you don't want to get rid of it, you better look at it very, very carefully. Because we can use fear to rationalize and justify not doing things we really ought to go do, or just as importantly, to rationalize and justify doing things we shouldn't do. Let me give you an example this morning. I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to please be honest with me. How many of you in this room would like to go back to school and finish your education? Could I see your hands? Man, there's a whole bunch of you that would like to do that. I'm going to ask you another question. Please be honest with me. How many of you really intend to do that? Could I see your hands? I'd say less than a fourth of the hands went up this time. Why? Nothing in the world but fear. Fear we can't measure up. Fear of failure. Fear of hard work keeps us from doing things we really would like to go ahead and do. So if we've got one of those and we want to get rid of it, let's look at it closely. We're using it to rationalize and justify just exactly like we did with resentments. we can get rid of those fears too.
I had this friend named Todd. And Todd, about 12 years ago, I was sponsoring him, and he was unemployed and unemployable. And I said, Todd, is there anything you want to do with your life? What would you have always wanted to do? He said, well, I've always wanted to be an engineer. I said, well, why don't you go back to school and be an engineer? He said, I don't even have a high school education. I said, well, go back and get your GED and go to Tulsa Junior College, and maybe you can go into college. Well, he did those things, got on the Dean's Honor Roll in the Tulsa Junior College, got a Scholastic Scholarship at the University of Tulsa Engineering School in Tulsa, and today he's an associate engineer out in Sacramento for a company. He called me last summer and he said, you know, I've got 3 more months of going to school and I'll be a full-fledged engineer. Yeah. Way back then, he said, do you have any idea how old I'll be when this happens? I said, you have any idea how old you're going to be anyhow? No? So he's got it today, thank God.
Okay, the third common manifestation of self. We talked about this storeroom that I had in the back of my head yesterday that was filled with guilt and remorse associated with the people I've hurt in the past. God can't get in that storeroom and direct my thinking until I do something about that guilt and remorse. I can't do anything about that guilt and remorse until I see the truth behind it also. Now, it seems as though we human beings hurt each other easier and faster in the sexual area than we do in any other way. Now, we're a little bit different than the other animals here on Earth. The other animals on Earth, they have the same sex urge that we do so that they can and will reproduce themselves. But the difference between the other animals and us is they don't have this thing called self-will. They can't make decisions about life. Whenever it becomes time for them to reproduce themselves, God usually signifies that by physical change in the female of the species. The male senses that change, prepares himself, the two join together. And it's kind of like bang, bang, thank you, ma'am. And when it's over with, they usually go their separate ways. You see, they didn't think about having sex before they had it. They couldn't determine when they were going to have sex. That was done on God's time. They can't determine who to have sex with in the majority of the cases. They can't determine how many times they're going to have sex. They can't determine what position they're going to have sex. Therefore, you very, very shokums among their animals here on Earth. I've seen a psychiatrist cat talking about sex function. I have those problems. I've never seen a cow on a psychiatrist's couch yet talking about sexual dysfunction. They just don't have those problems. We human beings are a little bit different. Not only do we have the sex urge, so we can and will reproduce ourselves, but God gives us this thing called self-will, and He allows us to make decisions about our sex life. You see, we can have sex any day of the year that we wish to. We can determine who we're going to have sex with. We can determine whether we're going to have sex with one or more sexual partners. We can determine how many times we're going to do it, providing we're physically capable of doing so. We can even decide what position we're going to do it in. Now, they tell me there's something like 64 different positions a human being can have sex in. I have no idea what they are. I only found 3 in my lifetime, and 2 of them damn near killed me. I'm not sure I'm going back to that either.
Gets excited, doesn't he?
So what we're going to do here for just a few minutes this morning is we're not going to talk about how we do sex. We're going to talk about how we think about sex. Because how we think about sex determines what we're going to do with it. And that in turn determines whether it's going to hurt other people or not, and whether we're going to have to suffer the guilt and the remorse and the fear associated with those kind of things. And Bill gives us a very simple procedure to do that. Okay, now about sex, bottom of page 68. Many of us needed an overhauling there. Now, you older fellows, don't get your hopes up. We're not talking about physical, we're talking about mental. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. and you and I have heard them all of our lives, as far back as I can remember. They're the ones that say sex is a dirty thing. You're only supposed to do it for one purpose, to reproduce yourself. You're only supposed to do it with one person at one time in one position. And to enjoy it is a very sinful thing. I've heard them as far back as I can remember. They are to the extremes on one side. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or it isn't the right kind. You hear them today. They're the ones who say you ought to be able to have sex anytime you want to, with anybody you want to, as many times as you want to. You ought to be able to enjoy it every time, and if you don't, there must be something wrong with you. And maybe they call that the sexual revolution. Main thing I see wrong with it, it happened 25 years too late for Joe and I to participate in.
Missed the whole thing.
Joe said he just missed the whole damn thing. With that. One school would allow Bad no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. It'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? And I read that last statement with great relief, because I knew this book was getting ready to condemn me for what I had been in the past. I knew it was getting ready to tell me what I was going to have to do in the future. And I'd already made up my mind that I wasn't going to pay any attention to it whatsoever. And I'm real glad to find out we're not going to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We simply are not going to get into that issue. Now, if we start trying to tell people how to conduct their sex lives, then surely we're going to begin to alienate people. And the purpose of this book is to be helpful, not to alienate others. Besides that, what's sexually acceptable in one part of the world may not be acceptable at all in another part of the world. So we're simply not going to get into that issue at all. What we are going to do is see a way to look at our own past sex life, to look at our own ideas about sex, to see if perhaps we've harmed some people through the sexual act in some way, to see if maybe we can't develop a new sex life in the future where we can still engage in it and enjoy it, yet at the same time not harm other people. And basically, that's exactly what we're after, to be able to have a sex life that's decent and good at the same time, not hurt other people and still be able to enjoy it. Joe?
I'm like Charlie. I don't want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct, and certainly I needed an overhauling there. And when I tell you where I got my information about sex, you'll not want to talk to me about it, I can tell you that. And if we're going to do what we did with the other resentment and fear, we're simply going to find the facts, we're going to face the facts, and we're going to engage in the process so we can accept the facts. And again, Dr. Ewing said, ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were the guiding forces of our lives, these people are suddenly cast to one side. Where did I get my ideas, emotions, and attitudes about sex? Well, when I was about 12 or 13 years old, we had sex education in school. They called it recess. And I got to thinking a lot about this. And I went to my mom. My dad had just got out of the nut house, and he was living in California. Couldn't talk to him about it. So I went to Mom, and I said, Mom, I've been thinking about sex, and scared her to death. She said, oh, my God, Benny Joe. That's my name, Benny Joe.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, Benny Joe. She said, that's not a good thing to be thinking about. She said, you're only supposed to have sex when you want to have children. And I thought, well, see, she had five children. She had sex five times. My dad, no wonder he was in the nut house. You know? And she said, besides that, you're supposed to, it's a dirty, filthy, rotten thing to do, and you're supposed to save it for the one you love. Think about that. I don't know where she got all that from. I guess from the Southern Baptists, I suppose. But anyhow, I somehow didn't quite believe what she was telling me. So I went to the only source of information that was available to me, and on the corner of 21st and Quanah, not Southwest Boulevard, 21st and Quanah, there was a little restaurant called the Jenkins Cafe. And all the kids hung around the Jenkins Cafe, the older kids. And there was a bunch of older, wiser, intelligent, experienced men and women of about 15 or 16 years old. And they were more than happy to share everything they knew about it. And boy, as they began to tell me how often they were going out with these little girls, two or three different girls a night, they said, and how often they were having sex, my eyes got to be that big around. My ears got real big. I was really interested. Now, the fallacy of all this is that I was sober and Alcoholics Anonymous for a couple of years before I figured out that they were lying to me. Or at least I hope they were lying. I don't. But I based my sex life upon what I heard on the streets. You think I didn't need an inventory in this area to find out what was true and what was not true? I did. And Charlie likes me to tell you the first time I had sex, I was selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightening, and inconsiderate, and I was also alone.
That's why he's wearing glasses today, too. Every time we say that, about a dozen of you guys whip your glasses off and put them in your pocket.
Well, used to say jerk them off, but we quit saying that. I see we all need an inventory here this morning.
You can tell we're building up the spirituality, can't you? Next paragraph, we see a set of instructions on how to review our past sex life, worded almost the same as the instructions for resentments and fears, except worded a little differently, which is Bill's normal way of doing that. So let's take a look at this next paragraph, Joe.
Reviewed our conduct over the past years past. Where have we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate?
That's column 5.
Whom had we hurt?
That's column 1.
Did we justify aroused bitterness, suspicion, aroused jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness?
Made that into column 4.
Or we had found.
That's in column 4.
What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. So, we put down the stuff in the name, go down that column, always going from top to bottom.
We gave you, to avoid confusion again, we gave you another little inventory sheet. We call it a review of our own sex conduct. Basically the same 5 type columns. Column 1, who did I hurt? Now, I doubt if any of us in this room ever hurt anybody in the sexual area. And we don't know exactly who that is. And sometimes we might have a question on, or what are the things we do to hurt people?
Bubba.
And we hurt people in the sexual area in many ways. You know, if I'm in a married relationship like I am, I go outside of my marriage and I have sex out there and my wife finds out about it, then certainly I've created a problem for her. But not physically, if not physically, at least emotionally. Sometimes we hurt people in the sexual area by demanding they have sex with us when they really don't want to. Surely we create a problem for them if we do that. If not physically, at least emotionally. Sometimes we hurt people in the sexual area that by demanding they do sexual things with us they really don't want to do. Surely when we do that, we create a problem for them, if not physically, at least emotionally. I think sometimes we hurt people in the sexual area simply by withholding sex when maybe we ought to give in more often. Many, many ways we hurt people in the sexual area. I think we all know what they are. I think we all know who we've hurt. Column 1, we begin to make that list. Column 2, what did I do to hurt them? You know, did I demand to have sex and didn't want to? Did I commit adultery? What was it I did to hurt them? If we know who we've hurt, we certainly know what we did. Column 3, affects mine. Now you would think that if I hurt anybody in a sexual area, it would be caused by the sex instinct. And I guess once in a while that's probably true. Sometimes to get the physical, the emotional gratification that comes at the moment of completion of the sex act, maybe I'm doing the wrong thing at the wrong time, because of the sex instinct. But I think if I really carefully look at each situation, I'm going to find in the majority of the cases, the other two instincts are involved just as much as the sex instinct, In many cases, I'll probably find that they are more at fault than the sex instinct, and sex really didn't have anything to do with that at all. Now, I'm going to make a statement. I'm going to express an opinion. And I want to be sure everybody understands now this is my opinion. Not either one of these Joes, not AA's, but Charlie's opinion. I'm convinced today that God gave us the sex urge so that we could reproduce ourselves. I'm also convinced He made it a very pleasurable thing so we would do so. I don't think we would do the kind of work involved in sex if we didn't get some kind of reward for doing it. So if we're doing sex for purposes other than reproduction or enjoyment, then we just might be doing sex for purposes other than what God intended. For instance, we boys found out at a very early age that you can use sex to build your self-esteem. After all, the more members of the opposite sex you could attract to yourself, the greater man you really are, we thought. Now, we boys call that John Wayneism. I don't know what you girls called it.
Jane Wayne.
Jane Wayne, Joe said. And some of you girls tell me you use sex for the same purposes, to build the self-esteem. Now, if that's true, then that has nothing to do with reproduction or enjoyment. That's to fulfill a part of the social instinct rather than the sex instinct, and sex really doesn't have anything to do with that. Well, sometimes we use sex to buy a personal relationship. Maybe we're just lonesome. Maybe we just want somebody to pay attention to us. And we found out a long time ago we can give sex and buy back a personal relationship. That has nothing to do with reproduction or enjoyment. That is to fulfill also a part of the social instinct. Sex really doesn't have anything to do with that. Sometimes we use sex to buy security. Maybe we're in a sexual situation we really would rather not even be in. But we found out a long time ago we've become so emotionally over-dependent upon another human being for our material well-being that we give sex to buy back material security. It has nothing at all to do with the sex instinct. It is to fulfill the security instinct. Sometimes we use sex to get even with another human being. Maybe we're in a relationship, we find out our partner's gone out and done something they shouldn't do, and it infuriates the hell out of us, we say we'll show them, and we'll go out and do identically the same thing. The fallacy in it is, we can't afford to tell them we did it after we did it. But there we certainly didn't use sex to reproduce or to enjoy, we used it to get even with another human being. Sex really doesn't have anything to do with that. Sometimes we use sex to force our will on another human being. Maybe our partner in doing what we think they ought to do, and we say, we'll show them. We'll just cut them off at the pass, and we won't let them have any sex till they come around our way of thinking. And we boys aren't very good at that. We only last 2 or 3 days. But you girls have honed it to perfection. You know exactly how to do that. And I don't blame you. I'd use it, too, if it worked that good for me. That has nothing to do with reproduction or enjoyment. That's to force our will on another human being. Sex really doesn't have anything to do with that. I think this third column is one of the greatest things we can do for ourselves when we honestly look at what's going on in our sex life. Two things begin to happen to me in the third column. Number one, a lot of guilt began to disappear. I thought I was just a dirty, rotten, no-good SOB. But I found out that isn't true. I use sex for purposes other than what God intended, not because I'm a bad human being, because I'm a sick human being, and I use that sex to fulfill the other instincts of life, and sex really didn't have anything to do with it. I always thought I was oversexed. No, I wasn't oversexed, I was undersecure. And I used sex to build my self-esteem, I used sex to build my security, etc. And when I began to see the truth behind it, that began to look kind of dumb to be doing that kind of stuff. The desire to go do it at the wrong time, in the wrong place, with the wrong person, began to become less and less and less when I actually could see the truth behind those sexual acts. And my desire to go do that became less. I began to get a handle on this sex thing right here in the third column. It's one of the greatest things I think we can do for ourselves. Column 4. What feelings did I create in others? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? What should I have done instead? Not only are we looking at the things we did to hurt another human being, we're going to try to shape a new sex life in the future. We need to be also looking at what should we have done instead of that in column four. Column five, same basic character defects. Did I do it through selfishness? Was it caused by dishonesty? Was it caused by being self-seeking and frightened? Was it caused by inconsideration of others? Every one of those sex acts is going to be at least one of those character defects, maybe a combination of every one of them in many, many cases. But in column five, I simply put what the character defect was that is involved in this thing. When I get through with this sheet, I've got identically the same thing that I had on the resentment sheet and the fear sheet. I'm doing column four. In the fifth column, we see the exact nature of the wrong. The wrong was the thing I did to hurt another human being. But what was at the core of it? Was it my selfishness, my dishonesty? What was the exact nature of it? Column five, I see the character defects I'm going to become willing to turn loose of in step six. Knowing if I stay selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate, I'm going to keep on doing the same old things. Keep right on hurting people, and they're going to retaliate. In column five, I see the shortcomings I'm going to ask God to take away in step seven. And quite naturally, all the names in column one, they're going to be people that I've harmed through the sexual act. They're going to come off of this sheet and be added to the sheet to be used later on for steps eight and nine. So when I'm through with this sheet, I've got the same thing I had for the other two manifestations of self. I'm going to have step four. I'm going to have step five, six, and seven. I'm going to have steps eight and nine, everything I need for my sexual conduct of the past.
I'm going to ask you, how many of you got your sexual information somewhat like I did? Somewhat. We need an inventory, don't we?
How many of you had sex the first time like he had?
Come on, be truthful now. You know, I remember my first got married a couple of years there, did okay, and then one night I went out on my wife. And the next day I felt terrible. I mean, I didn't know you were supposed to feel bad, but I did. I felt terrible. Guilty, shame, remorse, terrible. And those things are supposed to keep you from doing it again, but I didn't. I continued to do it from time to time. And the next time I did that, it wasn't quite so bad as the first time. And then the next time, it wasn't quite so bad as the time before. And as time went on, it got to where it didn't hurt at all. See, that's the principles. You know, if you don't have any principles to live by, ultimately, you don't have any reasons to live. That's how important principles are. That's why I needed to do what this book says. That's what I needed to do, and it says in the next paragraph, in this way, the way Charlie just described, the way the book just described, in this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We suggested each relation to this test was it selfish or not. We have to use prayer three different times in the area of sex, and here's the first one. We ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex prayers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor despised or loathed. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we've done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. More prayer. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it.
You know, in this area of my life, I know I've always had this knowledge. It seemed like we always know in a sexual situation it's wrong, whether it's right or wrong. There's nothing new. I've never been in a sexual situation that was wrong and I didn't know it was wrong. So I said, let that work in your life. Your answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. God alone. That's great to know. Counsel the other person are desirable, but we let God be the final judge. Realize that some people are fanatical about sex, others are loose. We avoid hysteria thinking our advice. You know, God, we know inside what we should do. And the only way we're going to develop that is use it and practice it in our lives. You know, we're going to ask other people about that. And I see it happening around AA. You know, it's a bad place to get sexual advice. And financial advice in AA. So we let God be the founder. We already know. I think we are the way in most cases. You know, I talk a lot of people out of the problem every day in their lives. I've been doing that for years of what I do. And I down on me many years ago, and everybody that comes to you with a problem, they already know the answer. Really, you can hear that they already know what to do. But they just don't want to adhere to it and do it. Suppose we fall short of the chosen idea and stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but this is only half true. It depends upon our motives. If we are not sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we've forgiven and learned our lesson. But if we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We're not theorizing. These are facts of our experiences. You know, anything that we do that's going to hurt another person is wrong for us. This is a rule that we can always use. To sum up about six, again, prayer. We earnestly pray for the right idea and for guidance in these questionable situations and for sanity and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves hard into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge.
The horny condition.
When the yield would be
hard. It quiets that horny condition is what it
does. And the yield would be heartache.
Okay, as I finished up this sexual inventory, went back and reviewed it again, looked at that column one, I was absolutely amazed to see in many cases the same names appearing on all three sheets. Barbara was on all three sheets. I resented her, I feared her, and I certainly hurt her in this area. I even had the Internal Revenue Service on all three sheets. I resented them, and I feared them, and I gave a pretty good screwing before I got through it. But I don't think we'll ever really tie all that stuff together in our head until we get these things down on paper and actually look at them and see the truth behind all this stuff. You can only see one thing at a time in your head. But when you get it all down on paper, look at it in its entirety, then and only then can we really see
the big picture.
The things that we've been doing in the past, how we've hurt other people with it, how that's created our resentments and our fears and our guilt and remorse. It is only then that we really become willing to do something about this stuff. You know, all that stuff that created problems for others is fun and pleasurable and exciting. And we lived on that all of our life. And sometimes it's hard to change those things. And we're not going to change them until we see the truth behind them. And the truth comes out as we fill out these inventory sheets. And we're going to make one more little suggestion before we leave the inventory in its entirety. It tells us when we get to step 8, we've got the list, we made it, and we took step 4. But we've got some names off of the resentment sheet. We've got some off of the fear sheet. We've got some off of the sexual harm sheet. But there's still probably some names of people we've hurt in other areas other than sexual that hasn't really popped up on these sheets yet. So we made up another inventory sheet. We called it a review of harms other than sexual. And we do it just like we did the other sheets. Column 1, who did I hurt? Those that I stole the money from, those that I hurt physically, those that I undercut them, took their job. If their names haven't appeared yet, I put them on this sheet. Column 2, what did I do to hurt them? Column 3, what part of self is affected? Column 4, what feelings did I create in others? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness, or desire to retaliate? What should I have done instead? And column 5, which character defect is involved? We finish this sheet. Once again, we're doing step 4. We've got information for 5, 6, and 7 out in the 5th column. We've got information for steps 8 and 9 in column 1. And we finish this sheet up. We have now completed the inventory. We've looked at our resentments. We've looked at our fears. We've looked at our harms to others, both sexual and in any other way. Now let's see what the book has to say about that. If we've been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. A lot of people don't like this word analyze. They say utilize rather than analyze. And I think what they're saying is you better start taking action rather than sit around and think. But the word analyze in this particular usage is simply another word that Bill uses for truth. We've taken a truthful, honest, analytical inventory. To analyze something simply means to get down to the truth of it. He didn't say it, but we've listed and analyzed our fears. We've listed and analyzed our sexual harms. We've listed and analyzed harms done to others other than sexual. We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. Now listen, here's a promise. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies. My God, for an alcoholic to begin to learn that. What a radical change in personality is already taking place. For we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we've hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are now convinced that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you already made a decision,
step 3,
and an inventory of your grosser handicaps,
step 4,
you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself.
Okay, now he knows what he said, our grosser handicaps. Step 4 is just to take our grosser handicaps. We'll get into step 10, we'll be using that to refine that process. So, I think the greatest mistake is most people, everybody's trying to wait and take a perfect inventory. You know, we want to wait till we get well and take steps. But what we're supposed to do is take steps to get well. And what we have to do is come on in the program and do the best you can with your inventory. And then take step 10 for the rest of your life. We're never going to have perfection. But I see many people making a mistake, waiting around, and then hanging around AA, making everybody else sick, waiting to take the inventory.
What are the grosser handicaps anyhow, Joe?
Resentment, fear, sexual harm, and harm done to other people other than sexual.
What are the grosser handicaps?
Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, and inconsiderate attitudes.
You see, we've looked at those things. We've seen the truth behind them. We're beginning to get rid of some of that. Already, the personality change has taken place. We'll continue to work on this for the rest of our lives. So the best we can hope to do with step 4 is do the best we can. And then that gives us enough information. We can now then continue with the rest of the program. You see, you can't do steps 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 unless you've done a good step 4. So now that we've gathered up all this information in step 4, now then let's see what we're going to do with it.
Okay, let's go into page 72. It's called into action. It's not into thinking, but into action. And having made our personal inventory, what should we do about it? It's a good question, isn't it? Well, we've been trying to get a new attitude. Remember that Dr. Jim said ideas, emotions, and attitudes were the guiding force. We're trying to get a new attitude. We've seen what they are. And we're trying to get a new relationship with our Creator. And again, back on page 45, it said the main object of this book was to enable me to find a power greater than myself, which would solve my problem. So I'm trying to get a new relationship with my Creator and discover some of the obstacles in my path. And what are some of those obstacles? Resentment, fear, harms done to others, and harms done to others sexually. We have admitted certain defects. And what are these defects? Selfish, dishonesty, self-seeking, frightened and inconsiderate attitudes. Those are the defects. And we have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is.
We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we're admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter.
And we know that step five says, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. But if you'll notice here in the narrative on step five, he said the exact nature of our defects. He used the word wrongs in the step, the word defects in the narrative. It used to confuse people. And people used to ask Bill, they'd say, well, Bill, what's going on here? What's the difference between the word wrongs in step five and the word defects in the narrative, and why did you use two different words? Now, we've known two ladies that worked with and for Bill for years. They both tell us the same thing. That Bill would kind of rear back and smile, and he would say, when I took English and writing courses in college, they taught me never to use the same words over and over, because that shows how dumb you really are. He said, there's no difference in these things. He said, in step four, we're going to find those things that block us off from the sunlight of the Spirit. In step five, we're going to talk about them to another human being. In step six, we're going to become willing to have God remove them. In step seven, we're going to ask Him to take them away. And He said, you can call them anything you want to. A wrong, a fault, a mistake, a defect, a shortcoming, a personality flaw, or whatever. And you're going to find that as he goes through the book, that's exactly what he does. He refers to these terms using different words, all meaning exactly the same thing. So it doesn't make any difference whether we call it the exact nature of our defects or the exact nature of our wrongs. We're going to discuss with another human being what we found out in step four.
This is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defect with another person. They think we have done well to admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt that it's actual practice. We usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us don't necessarily go much further. We still be more reconciled by discussing ourselves with another person. We see a good reason why we should do so. The best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Time after time, the newcomer has tried to keep to themselves certain facts about themselves, trying to avoid his humbling experience. They have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having reserved the rest of the problem, they wondered why they fell. I think the reason is they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on some of the worst items in stock. They thought they had lost the egotism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. But they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense that we find necessary until they told someone else all their life story. And this is where, when we said he took, when they see this in step five, I don't know why it should affect the inventory because it's in step five. People see that all your life story in step five, and they go in and say, oh, that's what they wanted to do in step four. It has nothing to do with step four. You might tell someone all your life story, but you're not required to do that in step four. Write that down in step four. This is step five. More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much active. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is what he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. And the inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on the spree. Come to his senses, he is revoked by certain episodes he vaguely remembers. His memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think that someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far into himself. He hopes to never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension and makes for more drinking.
You know, we go back to this statement, until I told someone else all their life story. And we took that statement and we assumed they wanted us to write our life story in step four, and that's what we did, many of us. But as I talked yesterday, I find that 95% of my life story has nothing to do with my alcoholism anyhow. But I tell you what did have something to do with it. My resentments, and my fear, and my guilt, and my remorse had something to do with it. And if I've done the inventory like the book says, I've shared all my life story resentment-wise. My resentments didn't come just today. They've been popping in my head as far back as I can remember. I've shared all my life story fears-wise. They didn't come in my head just today. They've been popping in my head as far back as I can remember. I shared all my life story guilt, remorse, and harms-wise. I didn't hurt people as today. I've been hurting people as far back as I can remember. My mother said to me one time, she said, "Charlie, you were the meanest kid I ever saw." She said, "I had a little trouble loving you myself." Mm. And her mama's got a little trouble loving you, you know, you're in pretty bad shape. So if I have really, really, really shared my resentments and my fears and my harms and my guilt and my remorse, I have shared all my life story anyhow. That's what all my life story revolved around. The fact that I was born in 1929 has nothing to do with it, period. But those other things do. So we don't really have any quarrel with that statement.
And I like this idea, too. It said, "A solitary self-appraisal is insufficient." I did the very best I could do with the knowledge that I had and the understanding that I had when I did this inventory. It wasn't great. Nobody that I've ever known has done this perfectly. But I did the best I could do. And now, as important as these forms have been, they're really important now. Because now I can take these to another human being. And he and I can go from these things from left to right, discussing every column in depth as long as I wish to and as long as he wishes to, gleaning all the information about me that I possibly can, and especially the fifth column, because that's really what we're interested in, is where would we be selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate. That's, and he can help me see things that I couldn't see. Because you see, between me and me, there is a lifetime of rationalization and justification. I can't see through that. I can look around this room this morning, I can see defective characters everywhere.
Right there, one.
There's one right over there, a big one. Because the only difference between me and you is error. Now, if I had any character defects, I'm sure you could see them. I can see yours. Because there's nothing between you and me except error. Between me and me is a lifetime of rationalization and justification. I need another human being help looking at me through this inventory process to help me see things that I couldn't see. A solitary self-appraisal is insufficient.
Last paragraph on page 73 says, "Psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We spent thousands of dollars for examinations. We know but few instances where we've given these doctors a fair break. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else." Now, let's face the fact. We alcoholics have become the world's greatest con artists. You have to be if you're going to be a practicing alcoholic. You've got to learn how to lie, con, manipulate, cheat, steal, take advantage of others, and etc. if you're going to be a practicing alcoholic. If you've been doing that for 10, 15, 20, 30, or 40 years, you come to AA, you take step four, you be just as honest with yourself as you possibly can. But we got to face the fact it's impossible for us to be honest with ourselves. You know, we had that little thing called resentments, a very convenient thing that we used it to transfer blame to others so we never would have to look at ourselves. We've never been honest with ourselves or anybody else. So if we really want to see what our problems are, we're going to have somebody else help us see them. No human being, I don't care how perfect they are, can be entirely honest with themselves because of the three basic instincts of life that enter into the picture and cause us to rationalize and justify, and that's especially true for we alcoholics. We just can't see the truth about ourselves. Now, I know confession is good for the soul. I know if you belong to a religion that requires it, you need to go do that. But I also know that we ought to be taking step five with somebody that really knows and understands this program.